Tim Goldstein, autistic adult, and your host for Life in a Neurotypical Universe, where we take a look at life from the perspective of an autistic adult. Today we have a very special episode of Life in the Neurotypical Universe. In this episode, I'm actually chatting with my friend Chris Turner from Project Enterprise Coaching down in Australia. And it was actually just a call that we had to catch up and talk with each other. But I decided I would tape it and record it because we usually talk about some pretty fun and interesting things. And out of this whole thing, I was able to produce three very high quality, very interesting podcasts. This is the first of the three podcasts that I pulled out of Chris and I just having a friendly conversation around the world over the internet. So come join Chris and I, take a look into life in a neurotypical universe. We'll edit out any of the stupid stuff.
Jeez, you're not going to get left with much.
Well, how you been?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good, really, I think, overall. It's been a while since we last caught up, isn't it now? But
yeah, I mean, other than, just kind of a paragraph or two here or there on, I guess mostly it's been on LinkedIn or something. Yeah. That's about all we've been in touch for. Gosh, it's got to be at least 6-8 months range.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It's probably pushing up a year.
Probably close. You're right. It was probably early fall last year. So another month and a half, and we're about at the same point.
Yeah, that's it. I reckon it'd be about that. So,
wow. You know what I always say? This is my saying about that. Time, you know, everybody always says, of course, that time flies when you're having fun. We just didn't realize the amount of fun we've been having over this past almost year.
You know what? That's an interesting point. So I need to reflect back on that because some things must have been good. It has been. It's been quick. Yeah, for sure.
And that's the one where I wrote. I've heard through a lot of my life, just like many people who are neurodiverse here. Why can't you just act normal? Why can't you just be like everybody else? Or some other way to phrase the exact same sentiment. The answer is you can't be because that's not who you are. And the other problem is nobody ever explained to me how a neurotypical acts in a manner that made any sense to me. So if I don't have a model in my head to try and emulate, how am I going to act normal if I don't understand normal? I figured I should sit down and write out the instructions for how to act like how to understand being a neurotypical, written from the perspective of somebody who's autistic. And like I say, I think it's one of the best ones. And as I've given it to other people that I know who are on the spectrum, they've had the same reaction of, wow, this explains things that I've just never understood before. And my explanation really comes down to it's a concept I had picked up from another science magazine. I should stop reading science magazines. And this one dealt with, it was called the evolution of morality. And Well, it was very interesting.
Sounds like a long bow to draw, but how did you connect
that? You got to be into science first, magazines first, which we've eliminated a number of people. But what it was explaining, and it started out using chimpanzees as an example. And the norm amongst chimpanzees, according to the article, I haven't gone out and studied them to prove it myself, but these people seemed like they were fairly well researched, is chimpanzees, they say, will go out and look for food or hunting or whatever they're doing as a group. But once they find the food or whatever they're hunting for, it's every chimp for themselves. Hard to have a lot of morality amongst them when it's everybody for themselves. You're not thinking about anything else. Then in their concept, there was something that happened in humans at some point that changed it from being the me first, like a chimpanzee, into being we as the first thing you think about. Now, us people who are autistic didn't get that gene. We don't think about we. We tend to be, as you know, pretty self-centered and not have much theory of mind and understanding that other people have thoughts.
Yeah.
And that was kind of where the pivot point was, is thinking about that concept of what caused humans to be able to draw together and have, you know, if you don't have morality, you can't build civilization. You know, you have to have some level of morality to build upon. And what caused humans overall to do that? And, you know, they essentially, that caused them to go into tribes because they were thinking about the we now, because we can be more powerful and stronger and safer as we's.
Mm.
And that's kind of where the whole thing came from. And what the model that I really came up with is neurotypicals are just like indigenous tribes. If you sit back and think about it, you know, what's the number one rule if you were in an indigenous tribe? Don't get kicked out of the tribe because you're going to die. I mean, the tribe's it's going to keep you alive because you're in the middle of nowhere.
Safety in numbers.
Exactly, right? Exactly. And if you think about neurotypicals from the standpoint of being in a indigenous type tribe, so what, you know, 30 kind of people or so is usually what they range, you know, 20, 50 range, something like that. When you think about it from the standpoint of why did that person do that? Why did they not say what they were really thinking in that conference room when they had the opportunity to say it, but instead said something that made somebody feel good but had absolutely no contribution to solving the problem? Well, that's putting, you know, that's acting like the tribe. That's putting the we in front of the me because, well, maybe that person's more important to me, so I need to not offend them in any way or I'm going to get thrown out of the tribe. Now, being autistic, I don't even think about whether I offend him or not. I just tell him what I'm thinking. And that's where, to me, that model of the tribe model allows us on the spectrum to come up with a visualization, a mental construct that we can actually follow, because it makes sense if we just think about a tribe and how a tribe would act and what would happen if somebody in the tribe went and, you know, ran, I don't know, whatever, we'll say one of the kids ran to the top elder and tattled on, you know, their parents. Well, it's not going to fly in the tribe like that. That's just not the way it works. And, you know, I think you've probably run into that with autistic people. We have a tendency to not necessarily pay attention to the pecking order in the corporate environment. And if we connect well with somebody high up, and then we just talk to somebody high up, and they're just another person. But
I think there's good value in that as well, though. So it's not all bad, but
you know, but it does. That causes then you're riling the tribe. You're essentially a low-level person in the tribe, and you're talking to the chief. And other people don't like that. So I'm not saying I'm not saying it's 100% accurate. I'm just saying it's a model that to somebody who is
overarchingly
who is neurodiverse can picture that and can reason through why people would do things in that kind of culture. And if you just extend that into our current culture, you know what? It works pretty darn well.
Yeah. So it goes beyond the IQ, because I think the guts of it was that he recognized that IQ is measuring one type or one aspect of intelligence. And then he looked at I think there's eight that he looks at. And it's like musical, rhythmic, visual, spatial, verbal and linguistic, logical, mathematical, and kinesthetic, so body, naturalistic, interpersonal and intrapersonal. And then I was at a conference recently, and it was a bit of supposition because they plotted Einstein up on that, and they plotted another bloke up on there as well. But it was a little bit, you know, they don't know for sure. But it's kind of, if you go based on what we can tell about these people and what we know about them. But you see the same thing. So they plotted out on a bell curve. So, you know, most what that just a general standard distribution curve would look like. And then to say, well, where would some of these people fit? And as you go across some of these facets of intelligence, as it were, yeah, some areas are very, very high, some areas they're low, and some they're just somewhere in the middle, pretty much average like most other people might be. But it's those swings, and it's the swings where you go, well, if you took an average person, they're probably just average, you know. They sit in somewhere in within one standard deviation on these curves against each of these sorts of these traits, which is all we're talking about with this other stuff, is just a different representation. I thought you might find that interesting to have a look into, because I think it's a similar line of thinking, and it wasn't necessarily geared around autistic people versus non-autistic people or anybody else. But I think it's something that you could. Yeah.
I think it's a very true thing. I mean, you know, I think we all recognize that, you know, we've met people in our lives that in one of those categories you define, they're phenomenal. But in other categories, they're not. And, you know, I'm thinking what immediately pops to mind, not that there's not plenty of other examples, is, you know, take somebody who is a phenomenal musician. Well, you know, artists tend to not be necessarily the best logical thinkers. That's fairly common, you know. I mean, there's certainly plenty of artists that are logical thinkers, but, you know, it's also common where they're not. So I think we can see that there are certainly different types of intelligences. And part, I think, of the problem in the employment world for people who are neurodiverse is we don't look at those different intelligences. When you think about it, what are most corporate type interviews really, you know, amount to? They're really trying to judge your emotional intelligence. How well do you get along as part of the tribe? And they don't measure any, you know, maybe they'll measure one of the technical competencies because, you know, I'm a computer programmer, so they're going to see I can program. So they're really testing, they're looking for two competencies out of, you know, 8 or 9 potential areas of intelligence. They're looking for emotional, and they're looking for, you know, that one competency that belongs to whatever your career path is. But they're not looking at, you know, is this person, you know, maybe they're not smart here, but look at they're just phenomenally brilliant in these three other intelligences. So it's not a dumb person. They're just dumb in the one that you're trying to judge them by. But I think it just points out you can't pick one and make the judgment. And unfortunately, too many hiring processes are really doing that. They're focusing in on one or two of 7 or 8 different possible areas where somebody would excel.
Yeah, that's it. I think exactly right. And again, but again, it's not unique. That's not necessarily a unique challenge to autistic people either. And
also, that's why I say it's human traits. It's not autistic traits. We're just talking human traits. It's just that if you take, well, really, when you get down to it, if you think about how we came up with these categories came out of the DSM, you know, Diagnostics and Standard Manual. So, you know, it's a Bible for you know, psychiatrists to diagnose you, psychologists also. And they're categorical. They list a number of traits, and if you display these specific traits, then you have this condition. So is it really true that when you have all those traits, you have that condition, or did we just make this classification be, you know, basically self-serving because everybody that's in it has those particular traits because that's where we drew the border? You see, it's kind of an interesting thing. If we diagnose by looking at this list of criteria, and then we say that they're all like that. Well, yeah, because you made the list of criteria and you took everybody out that wasn't like the criteria. So now you've got a group that is like you're saying they are. But is that truly representative of the entire group?
Well, probably not necessarily. And I think that's where there's a few people who tend to fall through the cracks.
Right. And, you know, to me, the categorical thing is another one of those issues. You know, that's another soapbox issue that goes along with the continuum thing. Because I know just from my own work, and I'm sure from your own work too, there's many people who would not get an actual clinical diagnosis of autism. You know, they lack something out of the Chinese menu they just don't have. But on the other hand, there are challenges in life dealing with them, talking with them. They're as autistic as any other person. It's just that we came up with these stupid arbitrary boundaries. And you know, I kind of liken it to blood pressure. You know, we say 130 is high, you know, high blood pressure, and you know, 129 is you know, more of a just caution area. Well, my guess, if we went and dug in through the statistics, the difference between 129 and 130 is meaningless. Now, when you make the bucket say 120 to 129 is this condition, 130 and you know to 140 is this condition. Okay, there's some meaning, but what, you know, there's really not much difference between...
There's still a tipping point of one, isn't
there? Yeah, exactly, exactly. And that's the problem, I think, with the categorical diagnosis, is we've left a huge quantity of people out that can't get the benefits of what is slowly becoming available as far as services, you know, recognition of needing different accommodations. You know, what do you do with the poor person that... If you put them in a room with a bunch of diagnosed, you know, autistic people, nobody'd be able to figure out they weren't, but they don't have a diagnosis. Oh gosh, too bad, you're out. You don't get into this program, you don't get help. And that might be 1 point difference.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. That's why I think it's important to always go back to, as you're saying, like it's human traits that we're talking about. It's not autistic
Bingo.
Traits. It's and in terms of the value of being able to recognize, understand, and support differences in those traits, regardless of the individual, I think that you're getting to the point where you're setting yourself up to just be inclusive in its truest sense. As a byproduct, you'll be better able to support autistic people, but you'll be able to support everybody else as well, regardless of their background, their current state, etc. Like, you're just having an understanding of how someone may vary across those various characteristics. And for some people, that variation may be temporary.
Yeah, they may be, right, they may be under a lot of stress, they may be having a lot of anxiety. I mean, they had a fight with their, you know, their significant other that morning. The car, you know, had a problem on the way to work. They couldn't get in their favorite parking spot because they were late from the argument in the car. And then they walk in the door. They're not going to be, you know, they could be normally the most stable person, but that day is not going to be a good day for them. So you're 100% right. Yeah. There's a lot of situational that could take anybody and push them into acting like a different person.
Yeah, that's right. And I guess, as you say, like that situational pressures or inputs into shifting their normal pattern of distribution could be quite short-lived, or it could be quite, could have quite a long period of exposure. I'm thinking, okay, so if you've got a family member diagnosed with cancer, the way that that may affect you and how that may shift, you know, right, where you sit on that graph, that could be, it could move over time. It could be quite prolonged. Some people, it may not move them much at all. Others, it may move them a lot, but you know what I mean? But it may not be something that's going to be over by lunchtime.
You know, I think about it a little bit differently. I mean, similar in end result, but a little bit differently in the mechanics. And if you take human traits, and we'll just say, you know, whatever the collection of human traits is, and represent them as thermometers, okay? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the higher, more of that trait you show, the higher up you are in the thermometer. And we'll just set all these thermometers on some, you know, level base. So they're just all sitting there. And we're going to draw a line across that we're going to call clinically significant. So if you're you know, reading on your thermometer gets over that line, then you clinically see, you have a clinically significant amount of whatever that trait is. Now, those thermometers are going to be all over the place for, you know, as we just talked about. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're neurodiverse, whether you're neurotypical. The only difference being they're probably going to be more variation in the neurodiverse than the neurotypical, but nonetheless, they're not going to have identical values. So you could take somebody, take that clinically significant line, and nothing they have goes over the clinically significant line. They may have some high values, but they're just not high enough to be clinically significant. But the way I think what happens is when you induce stress on them, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's the you know, family member with cancer or the car that broke or the argument with the coworker. I mean, just stress, anxiety, you know, all those things. I don't think it so much pushes up the individual values in the thermometers as much as it pushes the whole base up. So you basically just raised the whole level up, but you didn't move the clinically significant line. So all of a sudden, your high thermometer just popped through the clinically significant from the stress that was piled underneath it. So, you know, take the stress and, you know, how do we work now compared to, you know, both you and I have, you know, a few gray hairs. So going back to when we were young and first started working, the workplace today is nothing like the workplace was when we started working. You were actually treated like a human back then, and you weren't, you know, there was actually a reasonable expectation that if you did a good job for the company, you would be around for a long time. Nowadays, it really doesn't matter how great a job you do. When they do a reorg, you're gone just because you happen to be in the wrong department. So that's another stressor. Yep. And so I think what it really is not that we're necessarily having higher levels on the individual values, but we're just shoving the base up higher and higher so that more people are showing clinically significant levels because we jacked up the whole thing, not that their thermometers went up.
Yeah, no, it's probably a better description, I think, and that's probably where my head was at, to be honest. But yeah, I think it's better.
Yeah, that one took a while, trust me. I've been working on that one. I still haven't gotten down to how to quite present it in a way that I feel is real smooth. But I think the concept helps explain a lot of, you know, we're seeing in so many different, you know, mental health, but, you know, that's also, I think, misleading to say that somebody who has autism is mental, you know, has a mental health issue. No, that's not true.
I don't think one equates to the other.
Right, but when we look through these things that we call mental health issues, even though, you know, you and I both agree that being different is not a mental health issue, it's just being different. You know, we're seeing higher levels. We're seeing higher levels of depression. We're seeing higher levels of anxiety. Yeah. We're seeing higher levels of autism. We're seeing higher levels of all these things. And if you take that model makes sense. Why are we seeing higher levels? Because, you know, when you and I were kids growing up, we didn't have to worry about whether our Facebook page looked better than the other person's Facebook page. You know, when you left school, guess what? All the bullies stayed, you know, they went away. Unless you had a bully in your neighborhood. Whereas nowadays, I mean, that stuff chases you no matter where you go. And you just think, you know, the work life, the stress of the, you know, technology, this always on, you know, expectation that just because you send me a Slack or a text, I'm supposed to drop everything I'm doing and answer immediately. I mean, that's crazy. But that's how we live now. And I think that's why, you know, in my mind, that's why we're seeing a lot of the issues we're seeing is we're stressing people out. Part of it's probably environmental. I mean, you know, the chemicals, the stuff in our food, all those things. We certainly know they induce stress. I mean, you know, whether they go beyond stress, that's, you know, all kinds of studies. But we certainly know if you ingest something that is not, you know, you ingest insecticide because it's, you know, in your fruits and everything because it was grown in there.
Yeah.
Well, you know that the body's going to have a stress response to it. That was a chemical that is, you know, not what your body uses and processes. I mean, the stress comes from all different angles. It comes from, you know, the demands upon us of the modern world, the technology that we all think we have to live with and, you know, love to death. You know, I personally learned to take a break from my phone every weekend. I leave it sitting in my office here at home, and unless I'm going out the door, it just stays there. I don't care. And if it rings, great. You know, who cares? I'm out mowing the lawn. I don't care. that was my way to cope with some of that, to try and reduce some of the stress, was simply say, no, it's ridiculous. Why do I have to answer it? I pay for the darn thing. Why do I have to answer it except when I want to?
Yeah. No, that's it. And again, not a unique.
No, not you.
It's a common challenge.
Exactly.
Right?
I think the only difference is, for me at least, with autism, you have a lot less concern about what anybody thinks about it. So I really don't care what somebody thinks about that I don't answer my phone. Oh, well, you don't pay for my phone. You don't pay for my time. So what? I don't care what you think about me because I don't answer my phone. I think you're an idiot because you answer yours every single time it rings.
I don't think being autistic, and this is what I say, I think a lot of these things, I don't think is unique to being autistic. I think it's probably far more common and typical with autistic people, but it's not unique to autistic.
You're 100% right, and I've been kind of working on a new line of work. And it's kind of the concept that what we always talk about is being traits of these different conditions. Medical traits, essentially. We talk about with autism that obviously the flat affect is a, fairly common thing. The lack of, the emotional engagement is a common thing.
Yeah.
But we've associated those as all being medical conditions. But the reality is they're human traits. I mean, it doesn't matter who you are, you're going to fall somewhere on the scale of that human trait of emotional engagement. And there's neurotypicals there's neurotypicals can be for every measure you can have, but emotionally, they're just not good emotional engagers. So you can't say it's an autism trait. It's just a human trait. It's just if you get enough of these human traits together at a high enough level, we just put this label on it called autism. So I think that's one thing to me that's important to try and get people to stop thinking about medical condition diagnoses traits and start thinking in the real world about human traits, and just different people have different levels and different combinations of those same human traits, which then makes the stressor portion, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether you're at low levels of those human traits or high levels of your human traits, other than if you're at high levels, you become the canary in the coal mine because you're going to see it there first. But if you keep doing the same problem, you're going to eventually see it all the way down the line to your most emotionally stable person, if you make it enough turmoil, will start struggling also. Which proves it's a human trait. It's not a condition trait.
No. And I think you and I might have talked about this last time, was around the idea of like a spider graph type representation of, and I think we did, it was, well, the one that I've seen, and it is around a series of typical characteristics that affect, that everybody shares, and things around like executive functioning, and it could be like that's social and emotional reciprocity and all those sorts of things, right? If you had a whole series of human characteristics in a circle, and you had that spider graph that would say like most neurotypical people might share or look like something that has a fairly common, similar sort of distribution across those various characteristics. Not everyone's going to be like that, though. But you might say it falls within a normal sort of range, and you might then say, well, a lot of autistic people would have a different looking graph where the spikes and the lows are distributed in a different kind of way, but it's really just saying, as you said, like everyone shares common characteristics. To the extent to which we either have or exhibit those may differ, but it's something we all share. Because it gets away from this whole deficit mindset around, there's something wrong that needs to be fixed. Which just drives me bananas. And it's just understanding it's just different.
It's funny that you talk about that, because I actually went out and have created that. I call it the NeuroCloud Survey, and it's actually on my website. People can go take it and do it as much as they want. It's totally free, and it's just sitting there in my blog section. And what I did was took what are some of the more common interactional traits. You know, I really didn't care about traits that are things that don't appear in, you know, in the wild. So, you know, if it's the trait of something that's hidden of, you know, you don't have good body sensation, which tends to be a fairly common autistic trait, who cares? Nobody's going to notice that. So I just took 28 different traits that are common interactional challenges around people neurodiverse. And then I plot them out on a radar chart. So, you know, radar chart's kind of a spidery kind of chart like you're describing. Funny part is exactly as you said, there is a pattern to doing it with neurotypicals, doing it with neurodiverse people. And
the patterns are different.
Well, right? the patterns are very obvious to spot, and it's not what traits they have. That's not the tip off. The tip off is two things. And the way that I have them set up is if you display more of a particular trait, you see, you know, the numbers further to the outside, higher level number, and, you know, zero is right dead set in the center. And what I see is people who are autistic have a tendency, if you averaged all the numbers out, to be at an average of around a 7 or so. And you see a lot of variation from their strong areas to their weak areas. I mean, you might see a swing of 8 points from strong to weak areas. But when you take a neurotypical, the average is more to a 3 to 4 range. And the difference between their strong areas and their weak areas, I mean, if your average is 3 to 4, you don't have a lot of range, you can spread them. So the high to lows tend to only be 2-3 point swings. So when you look at them, you can spot these things all the way across the room because I fill them in with blue. So the way it prints out from the screen is, the entire section that's contained within all the numbers are all solid filled blue. So you kind of have this star shape of blue. On a neurotypical, it's a very small star with very little difference between the body and where the arms stick out. With a neurodiverse person, it's a very big star with a huge difference between the body of the star and the tip of the, you know, pieces sticking out. So, yeah, you're 100% right. I've actually, you know, gone out and tested it, and the answer is yes, there is a very different appearance to looking at these, what I refer to as interactional traits. And then where I took it to is, I hate that term high functioning and low functioning, because what does it mean? I mean, I was fired twice last year from, six-figure jobs. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's in your country or my country, six-figure jobs are pretty darn good jobs. And, does that make me high functioning or low functioning? I mean, that's pretty low functioning to get fired from two of them like that. But on the other hand, these are very high-end jobs, and you got to be pretty high functioning to even get into them. So, to me, the term is useless. And what I've done is taken that other piece, and I refer to it as interactional alignment, which now has totally gotten away from that continuum model of thinking low to high. You and me both. Get me on my soapbox. The concept of interactional alignment that I'm trying to get, and it's actually people are picking up on it quite well, is that do your strengths and your weaknesses align well with the environment that you're wishing to be in? That's the idea of interactional alignment. There's no assignment of it's good or bad. I mean, maybe you don't have phenomenally great skills and, you get a job as a janitor. Well, if that fits your temperament, your skills, your traits, that's a good alignment. You're probably going to like it and enjoy it, and it's probably going to stay there. Versus taking somebody where, that does not align with them, it's going to be a bad fit. But you don't get that out of high and low functioning. You only get it by looking at, where's the areas they're strong and where's the areas they're weak, and does it align with the demands of what they're going into?
Yeah. And that's applicable to everybody.
Again,
as well, right?
Exactly. I mean, how many people are in careers that, if you sit down and talk to them, they wish they never got in it, but they're just so far and so deep into it that they don't realize you can change careers. I'm on my, I think, fifth one now. What the heck? Change careers. They don't have to be anything similar. But most people don't think that way.
So it doesn't say, going back to you saying that the difference in the variability across those two like views, the graphs, that doesn't surprise me, because that's, and I've probably been going on gut rather than anything else, because I haven't done the research. I haven't done even any small scale study, but yeah, it doesn't surprise me, because I always tell people, you know, the key difference that I try to describe to people is that you're talking about someone who shares the same characteristics, the same fundamental traits that you have. It's the range and the variation is different. That's the key thing. So where someone is strong, they're probably far stronger on average than the average other person will be. But conversely, where there's a deficiency or a weakness or a low point, it's probably lower on average than the average other person.
Yeah, I think.
So you get these greater swings, yes, in their capabilities compared to most. And then the question then becomes around, well, you really want to try to cater, find the roles that can optimize and max leverage the upsides, and just find ways to help understand and accommodate the low sides. So, you know, whatever that, wherever they're going to have more trouble compared to other people, if you can make that work for them and you sensibly, you've got all this amazing upside that you can take advantage of, right? And you're going to have someone who's really happy doing what they're doing, which is ideal, because we all want that. But the opportunity to really take that cream off the top is huge. You've just got to cater a little bit down wherever the other parts are, whatever it might be.
Right, you know? Very much.
And everyone's different. You got to get across that, right?
But I think you're 100% right on the when you introduce autism, what you're doing is you're widening the spread. And to me, an area you can see that very clearly, and you know, is when you're looking at IQ. And okay, we can argue about IQ and how accurate and all that stuff is, but it's a proxy, and it's accepted as having some level of value. And I think what you see is when you go into the neurotypical population, of course, 100 is the average number. I mean, that's how the scale was built. And you see, a smaller number that get up into the 140 and, which is getting into the genius range, or under 80, which is considered in the, mentally, incompetent, essentially, range, I guess intellectual disability would be the correct term there.
Yeah.
And I think what happens is when you introduce autism, you're basically flattening the curve out. So you're taking and pushing down the center, but you're pushing them out to the side. So you now have a group, and statistically, I mean, the research shows if you're autistic, there's a, and I've heard numbers of 20 or 30%, but your chance of having an IQ over 120 is in the 20 to 30% range if you're autistic. On the other hand, your chance of having being under 80 is 20 to 30% also. Whereas for the normal population, those numbers aren't that high. The numbers are closer to that, the bell curve is tighter around that 100 center point. But when you put autism in there, yes, they would still average at about 100 average, but the difference is we've spread it over a lot wider range of the scale now. We didn't pack it all right towards
sort
the center.
A lower fatter curve.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's true of all these different traits, is the difference when you're dealing with somebody who is, neurodiverse, thinks differently, processes differently, is you really just expand the scale. Maybe they'll be phenomenal at it, beyond what most people would be. But maybe they'll also be just horrible. I mean, like me picking up on emotions. I don't.
Yeah.
My wife gives me the elbow and says, can't you see that they're like trying to get out the door? And nope, didn't miss it. Totally didn't get it at all. You know? How could people reach out to you, Chris, and contact you if they want to know more of what you're doing down there and would like to talk to you?
So I'm most on LinkedIn. That's my social platform of choice. Easily found on LinkedIn. Otherwise, I've got my own site, which is Project Enterprise Coaching. and doing a lot more around training and education for employers at the moment around hiring and managing neurodiverse people.
Well, perfect. We'll
so that's the game.
I'll put the web address and such down in the notes as this gets all turned into a real podcast, so that people don't have to try and, you know, keep rewinding and write down the names and exactly perfectly. Well,
yeah, sure.
Wonderful, Chris. Always, it's always great chatting with you. And gosh, it's been way too long. We hope that you've enjoyed another episode of Life in a Neurotypical Universe. Please, if you enjoyed this, share it with your friends. Go take their phone and subscribe them. Heck, it will help us all out. If you want to know more about neurodiversity or have any questions for me, you can reach me at my website, timgoldstein.com, where I'll be more than glad to help you as best I can to navigate through the neurotypical universe.